I'm Bill Hemmer, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, September 14th, 2018. I'm Chris Foster. Her friend Lanny Davis says Hillary Clinton would be president except for James Comey.
It is absolutely indisputable that James Comey should have been fired for violating at least 50 years of Justice Department policies.
And Lisa Brady. After more allegations of clergy sex abuse, the Pope faces more criticism for not doing enough and tries to respond.
The cover-ups have continued and continue to this day, and I think that's really the major source of the outrage that we're feeling now.
And I'm Chris Wallace. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
On July 5th, 2016, 3 weeks before Hillary Clinton won the Democrats' nomination for president, FBI Director James Comey held a press conference to talk about the investigation into her private email server.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information.
So no criminal charges, the campaign goes on. And then, on October 28th, 11 days before the presidential election, a letter from Comey to Congress announcing the FBI has learned of the existence of emails that appear to be pertinent to the investigation. They were found on a laptop computer belonging to former Congressman Anthony Weiner that was also used by Clinton aide Huma Abedin. After a review of those emails, Comey told Congress November 6th there was still no crime. 2 days later, Donald Trump won the election.
It is absolutely indisputable that James Comey should have been fired for violating at least 50 years of Justice Department policies.
Lanny Davis is an attorney, former White House counsel to President Bill Clinton, and an attorney for former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen now. His latest book, now out in paperback, is The Unmaking of the President, How FBI Director James Comey Cost Hillary Clinton the Election.
Hillary Clinton made a lot of mistakes that contributed to her defeat. I use the word contributed rather than caused, and I'll explain in a second. Of all people who say that, is Hillary Clinton, starting with the decision on emails and the way she handled the emails, many other things that were mistaken, campaign strategies, messages, some of the words that she chose she wished she could take back. So let's at least agree that it's possible for two facts to be true at the same time.
We absolutely can. I may ask a version of it, but I want to see what you have to say about the way I formulate it. But please continue.
Okay. We've been friends, Hillary and I, since law school when her last name was Rodham before she met her future husband. It's no secret that I love her as a friend, and I'm not unbiased here, but that's number one. Number two, despite all those mistakes, this is a fact that simply nobody has been able to refute. I'm always open to evidence to say that I'm wrong. On October 28th, 2016, in the morning, as opposed to the afternoon of that date, Hillary Clinton, by every single poll in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and by every national poll, is substantially ahead of Donald Trump. 5 to 7 points in three states that were much closer in 2012, 2008, and before. Those are not blue states. Those are purple states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. So in the morning, she's ahead in North Carolina, Florida, Arizona, is close in Texas and Georgia, and looks to be primed for certainly she's ahead by a larger margin 11 days out than Barack Obama was over Romney. That's simply a fact. 3 hours later is the release of the Comey letter that leads to 24/7, 11 days of a headline that says Hillary Clinton under new emails criminal investigation. 24/7, I've tracked it through the Shorenstein study that looked and read every news outlet, every television program for 11 days and tracked the coverage. 95% of the saturated coverage was the headline, Hillary Clinton under criminal investigation. Soft Hillary Clinton voters, of which there were too many as far as I'm concerned, but there were many who didn't like her but liked Donald Trump less, stayed home or switched. And the decisive event after all her mistakes, she would have won but for the Comey letter. That's my argument, but I present lots of data more than just polls. I present data about people's feelings towards the candidates that in the morning Clinton had reached about a 50-50 favorable, unfavorable after being 2-1 negative the entire campaign. She'd actually approached on October 28th, 50-50. Within 3 days, she dropped nationally 5 points. She dropped 10 points in those three states. And the negative went back to 2-1, not liking her, within 3 days. So that's the kind of evidence I present. And what I would like to say is an accurate description, the decisive effect of the Comey letter.
It's a really, really focused book. I mean, I expected sort of more of a narrative overview of the campaign, but it's just like 150 pages just about the Comey stuff, and then a final chapter we'll get into in a minute.
Right.
Now, it's an analogy that I want to see you poke holes in. Really good football team loses on a bad call in the fourth quarter. Why weren't they up 40 points in the first place to overcome that bad call? What about dropping the pass in the third quarter? What about not campaigning in Michigan?
Great question. When my son complains about an umpire call and they lose in the last inning because he struck out, I always say to him, so you're complaining about the umpire call 3 innings ago? Why'd you strike out?
That's my question.
No, that happens to be absolutely correct. And that's why you have to look at both things together. She made lots of mistakes that she could have won the election. She should have been way ahead of Trump. But the other thing that Nate Silver of 538, who does all of the polling analysis, probably the best in the country, wrote on May 17, 2017, when he looked back on the impact of Comey, had the following sentence. Of course Hillary Clinton should have been ahead by more, but on the morning of October 28th, she was about to win by a landslide. So it wasn't even close on the morning. Now, should it have been greater than that? Well, Lyndon Johnson, the greatest landslide in American history, was 60-40, which is exactly where Trump is today, 40%. So, yes, she should have been ahead by more, but had the Comey letter not been written, all evidence shows she would have won by a landslide.
You blame some media coverage of all this, too. Did we get it wrong,
Yes. Or
did we just overplay it, or both?
No, definitely didn't get it wrong. In some cases, the overplay was justified because what she did on emails, and I would say, just as a crisis manager, the mishandling of what she did on emails, the failure to be transparent right up front and get it all out right immediately, take all questions, not be hesitant to answer questions, all of that made the story worse. But yes, there's no question, according to Shorenstein, the Harvard Center that studied the media coverage, and many others, that the disproportionate coverage of emails as opposed to everything else was not good performance by the media.
And you say that Comey didn't really have the authority, not only did he diverge from past practices, you don't think he had the authority to do what he did, coming out in the first place by talking about the investigation.
It is absolutely indisputable that James Comey should have been fired for violating at least 50 years of Justice Department policies, express rules in the U.S. Attorney's handbook to which he's subject, and that the Deputy Attorney General should have fired him. And I blame Sally Yates for not having the temerity or the courage to pick up the telephone and order him not to send the letter. On the evening before he sent the letter, as I wrote, because I interviewed people as a good reporter who were in the room, he said, I'm going to send the letter because the Republicans expect me to. So it was a very political decision. But he also said, if anybody in the Attorney General's office wants me not to send this letter, tell them to pick up the phone and order me. Nobody did.
We hear a lot now.
He had no authority. Okay. Yeah.
We hear a lot now about how the FBI and the DOJ are just really out to get President Trump. Well, whatever, two and a few months ago, they were apparently really out to get Hillary Clinton, you say.
Silly. FBI agents are professionals. Every experience I've had with the FBI over all the years is nothing but admiration. But it is a simple fact that FBI agents are human beings. We know about the text messages that don't look so good when they're read in public by two human beings who happen to be doing something illicit, and they have their human weaknesses. We also know, as a matter of public record, that the New York City FBI office was extremely anti-Clinton. They wanted to launch a criminal investigation of the Clinton Foundation. Then they leaked a story, which is a matter of public fact, that it was Justice Department in Washington that squelched the investigation of the Clinton Foundation. James McKay, fired by Donald Trump, was the one on the telephone anonymously doing background conversation with the Wall Street Journal, which the inspector general was very critical that McCabe did that. So, of course, the FBI isn't politically biased. There are individual agents who are human beings, shocking. But for Donald Trump to try to demonize the FBI is one of the many, many instances of abuse of power that leads me to that last chapter as to why impeachment should at least be looked at.
Real quick, we don't have much time left. Your client, Michael Cohen, is waiting to be sentenced on tax fraud and campaign finance charges. Does President Trump have anything to fear from him? You've said that he's prepared to be as useful as possible to prosecutors, federal and state, and the Mueller investigation. Is he just over Donald Trump? Does he feel stiffed? Or does he feel like he can help himself at sentencing?
So given that I've had a couple of rough weeks trying to figure out what I'm allowed to say about Michael, he's still my client. And you've seen me, what was I doing, self-flagellating for 2 weeks and accepting responsibility for making a mistake, et cetera. So I can't answer your question, but here's what I can say. I've gotten to know this guy. He's led a life of doing the bidding of Donald Trump, and I didn't take him on easily for that very fact. I believe in my heart and gotten to know his heart that he's undergone a personal transformation in looking at Donald Trump as president of the United States and the danger he represents to our country and to our families. And that's a genuine transformation. You can't say he's trying to plea bargain because he's already pled guilty and he's going to jail. Someday, Michael Cohen will tell his personal story. That's the best answer I can give you.
Fair enough. Lanny Davis, new book out in paperback now, The Unmaking of the President 2016, How FBI Director James Comey Cost Hillary Clinton the Presidency. Lanny, thanks a lot.
Great interview. Thank you so much.
This is Chris Wallace with your Fox News commentary coming up.
It's been 16 years since revelations about clergy abuse in the Catholic Church first went public, prompting new protocols on how the church should handle claims involving minors. Though that did not cover the potential abuse or harassment of adults, including seminarians, and it didn't include bishops who've been accused of covering up abuse. And the revelations just keep coming.
We can express our feelings about these horrible crimes in two words. Those are shame and sorrow.
Vatican spokesman Greg Burke, after a grand jury report in Pennsylvania last month accusing hundreds of priests of decades of abuse. Pope Francis released a letter to the people of God condemning atrocities, talking about the pain of the victims, and saying the church failed to act in a timely manner. But the Pope is now accused of interfering with past punishment of now ex-Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, who resigned in July over abuse allegations. The head of the U.S. Conference of Bishops, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, wants a Vatican investigation of that. He was among those granted an audience at the Vatican Thursday, even as the Pope ordered a new investigation into claims against a West Virginia bishop accepting his resignation ahead of a summit with bishops from around the world in February.
The meeting in February is significant, although the announcement suggests that some of the most important issues are already off the table.
Phil Lawler is editor of Catholic World News, an independent service providing news on the Catholic Church.
The announcement indicates that the discussion will be about how to protect minors and vulnerable adults. It does not speak to the question of how to investigate the corruption that has been exposed in the last few months. It's certainly a big deal. It's unprecedented to call the presidents of all the world's bishops' conferences together for a meeting. But what will that meeting do? It's unfortunately all too easy to believe that it will be more talk and still not any significant action. As for calling for the American bishops asked for an audience. The president, Cardinal DiNardo, is president of the U.S. Bishops Conference, asked for an audience with the Pope, so it's not at all extraordinary. In fact, it's a little surprising that it took more than a month for it to happen.
Cardinal DiNardo has also requested a full-fledged Vatican investigation involving the allegations of a cover-up involving the Pope in regards to the scandal surrounding ex-Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. Do you see that going anywhere?
That's really the best hope, because only the Pope can authorize an investigation of bishops and require bishops to cooperate with it. So I hope that the Pope would organize that investigation, and I hope he would take steps to ensure that it's legitimate and independent investigation, but we don't know yet whether that's going to happen.
When you first heard about the initial revelations about widespread, you know, clergy abuse incidents, and by widespread I just mean in a lot of different parts of the world, not just here in the U.S., what were you hoping to see? Were you hoping that, you know, a lot of priests and maybe bishops and maybe even cardinals would be defrocked or stripped of duties? What would you like to see happen?
At this point, I would definitely like to see some severe disciplinary action. I mean, to put it simply, heads must roll if the hierarchy is going to regain public confidence. Earlier, it might have been, by earlier, I mean 20 years earlier, it might have been adequate to discipline a few bishops and a fair number of priests, obviously. And that might have been enough to satisfy people that a legitimate disciplinary action was going on, that the hierarchy was truly committed to rooting out this corruption. But at this point, it's gone on so long, and the revelations are coming after so many promises, that it's going to take much more.
How big a hit do you think the Catholic Church has taken from this?
Enormous, incalculable. It's the most devastating thing that's happened to the Catholic Church, at least since the Reformation.
Lauren Green, Fox's chief religion correspondent, agrees.
This is awful. This is a crucial moment in the history of the U.S. Catholic Church, and this is what pundits are telling me. It is a moral catastrophe, which is what Cardinal DiNardo called it. People criticizing the church have different scenarios of or why this is happening. I mean, you get things from Protestants who say, you know, if priests could marry, then you wouldn't have this. Well, you get abuse in Protestant churches as well, you know, where priests are accused of sexual abuse. The difference is that the Catholic Church is one monolith monster. It's huge. It's centered in the Vatican in Rome. It's a very big target, and it's easy to hit. And that's not to negate or to minimize the abuse. It's not at all. But it's just, it's a verifiable target you can go after, whereas abuse in the home, abuse in public schools is not quite as centralized. And because I cover this, the church and religion a lot, I see that there is a lot of abuse that happens everywhere in the world. It's just the Catholic Church really is a big target. And like I say, it's not to minimize the abuse to victims. And it's not to minimize also the fact that these are men of the cloth that should know better, you know, that they are the most trusted human beings on the face of the earth in terms of Catholicism. If you're a Catholic, a priest is sacred. A priest is God's representative on earth. So in that way, it is the most heinous kind of abuse that could ever be out there.
And for the vast majority of great priests who are doing wonderful work in their local communities, in churches across America, this has to be so difficult because you're, you know, trying to stay the course and to reassure people.
Right, right.
But they must be facing a lot of doubt and a lot of skepticism and a lot of anger.
Well, definitely a lot of anger. The a priest I talked to said, you know, 40,000 priests that are in America, there were since 2002, there have been like six cases or something of verifiable priest abuse, and four of them were for the same priest. So like I say, a lot of these cases are before 2002, but there is a lot of anger. When you're a priest and you try to be the priest that you set out to be to say your vows, even, you know, of chastity, of celibacy, all of those things, and try to help people, because that's part of being able to help people is to be celibate. To not have a family to worry about, you know, my children need shoes, and I can now worry about my parishioners who need shoes or clothing or food or something.
What do you think can help at this point? I mean, some have called for the Pope's resignation. What can turn the tide on this? What can make it better?
I mean, I love what Austin Ivory said. Austin Ivory is a Vatican pundit. He's really written books about the Pope and Catholicism has a great article out. But he talks about the problem is that the aim of the church is not punitive. It is not like, I'm going to get you and I'm going to bring you to the courts and I'm going to put you in jail. The aim of the church is redemption and that all souls can be redeemed. And so you're kind of operating on a different philosophy than the secular world and the civil courts. The civil courts want to take a priest who has abused a child to court and put him in jail. The Catholic Church, their mindset is on he is guilty of something and he does need to go to be arrested for this because it's a crime. But they're also concerned about redeeming the soul. And so you've got these two things operating at the same time.
In one of the local churches where I live, they not only talked about the most recent revelations out of Pennsylvania during Mass, but they also sent out an email saying, look, we're just as horrified about all of this as you are. I mean, is that really all they can do at the local level is say, yeah, we're very distraught over this as well?
Churches really can do more than just talk about how horrified they are. They really can bring their parishioners into the process of the cleansing and the healing. Help them understand what kind of measures that they can take and know that they can make those demands on their priests. Very important.
Though Pope Francis inherited this crisis, some critics have suggested that he stepped down. I asked Phil Lawler if that would help.
I don't know, because his resignation by itself would not accomplish a whole lot, I don't think. I do think that he has reached the point where there's a crisis of his leadership, and one of the possibilities for this meeting in February would be the equivalent of a vote of no confidence from the world's bishops. But Pope Francis is in a unique situation because he not only inherited it, but he compounded it, apparently, according to the charges against him. So he really does need to take some dramatic action himself, and resignation obviously is one step that he could take, but another step that he could take would be honest public recognition that he has mishandled this and that he needs to ask forgiveness for himself for his errors.
Phil Lawler, editor of Catholic World News, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Download Living the Bream with Shannon Bream.
Brett Baer, welcome.
Living the Bream, I love it.
We found it was the right level of cheese.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe too much, but
No, that's good. Less.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
This week marked 17 years since the attacks of September 11th, 2001. It's a time when many families, survivors, and first responders gather in Lower Manhattan to remember those they lost. I went to the 9/11 Memorial to cover that event, and on the corner of Cedar and Greenwich, across from the FDNY Memorial Wall, there were dogs, five or six of them. They were therapy dogs. They'd been brought down to give those leaving the closed-off memorial area some comfort. I watched as uniformed first responders, family members, and others leaving the memorial service exited the roped-off area, some of their faces grim, sad, numb. Many of them would see the dogs. They'd break into a smile and stop to lean down and pet their soft fur. This scene repeated over and over, and I had to know more.
My name is John Hunt. I'm with the Tri-State Crisis Response Team.
Okay, and you are with a quite beautiful animal. Who's this?
This is Gunther. He's a five-year-old Rottweiler.
And he's wearing a little tag that says, I'm a therapy dog.
Right. All the dogs you have from the Tri-State group are all therapy dogs, as well as having crisis response training, which is the extra training we have. We've responded to events such as Parkland. We were in Vegas. We were in Pulse. We were in Texas for the Baptist, you know, shooting.
Oh, yeah, we know
so
that
we
dog.
Respond to events like this, as well as to coming to events such as this, where we can pay tribute to our first responders and others who may be part of the families of those impacted by 9/11.
You have several dogs out here, and they're all absolutely gorgeous.
What do you normally see when you bring the dogs down here on 9/11?
Well, again, if nothing else, it helps people decompress. It's emotional support. You have a lot of people who are going through a range of emotions, and sometimes it's easier for them to interact with a canine, with a dog, than it is another individual. So, I mean, that's what we do. We've been interacting with a lot of family members and other first responders, and we've had great success, if nothing else, helping them to decompress.
That must be quite a view that not a lot of other people get when you go to these areas that have had such tragedy. How do you have to emotionally prepare for that?
Well, again, we have our own specific training that we go through ourselves. There's different levels of training. We just have our normal therapy dogs that may go to hospitals and churches and libraries and schools. And then other team members, they actually go through a higher level of psychiatric first aid training to prepare us, not only ourselves mentally, but how to interact with people appropriately.
What, is there a difference in the level of training for the dogs?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, some of them just have the Alliance of Therapy Dog Certification. The crisis response training is much more intense. It's a couple of days of full training, about 16 hours of training you have to go through. There's times where we put them with sirens. We put them in other environments which would be more challenging for them, which perhaps a regular dog might not be able to make sure they can encounter and go through the environment.
So you could turn this ambulance siren on right now and Gunther wouldn't budge?
He wouldn't care.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, I mean, not one of these dogs, they're used to it, especially the way we train. And we've had enough events that we've responded to that they're used to it.
The dogs also make trips to local health facilities and schools as part of their mission of comfort and emotional support. You can find out more about the group at their website or Facebook page, Tri-State K-9 Crisis Response Team. In New York City, Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
No holds barred talk, can't miss documentaries, specials, and more. Plus, your favorite Fox News personalities. This is our time, and this is going to be our place. Fox Nation, coming soon. Sign up for updates and be the first to know. Go to FoxNation.com now. It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Hi, this is Chris Wallace, anchor of Fox News Sunday. And the big story this week will, of course, be Hurricane Florence, which is bearing down on the coast of the Carolinas and is going to be a major event. We're not quite sure how big, but it will be still happening, unfortunately, on our shift Sunday morning. They're talking about as much as 40 inches of rain, 13-foot storm surges. It's going to cause a lot of property damage, and we hope not a lot of human injury. While the main focus always is on people's welfare, these things also end up being political, whether it's the garbage getting picked up or snow being cleared, or in a huge case like this, how government, local, state, and federal responds to the hurricane. We'll be talking to top federal officials as well as officials in the localities that are most affected by it. So stay tuned. We'll be all over this story this Fox News Sunday.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.